From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Photographer Dwayne Michaels takes pictures of subjects that are very elusive for a photographer, our fears, dreams, and desires. On this edition of Fresh Air, I speak with one of photography's top artists. Also today, we talk with Signe Wilkinson, one of the few women political cartoonists. She's the editorial cartoonist at the Philadelphia Daily News, and she draws a monthly cartoon for Ms. Magazine. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of music from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker, and commentator Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation of Raymond Chandler on the centenary of the master detective writer's birth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Photographer Dwayne Michaels has observed that people believe in the reality of photographs, but not in the reality of paintings. Michaels plays on this expectation to give illusion the appearance of reality. Using double exposure, he makes surrealistic, dreamlike pictures. Sometimes he creates his own stories, casts friends in the different parts, directs the scene, and records the story in a sequence of still photographs. Michaels' photos have been exhibited in museums around the world, and he's represented by the Sidney Janis Gallery in New York. He's also maintained a flourishing career as a commercial photographer. His assignments have ranged from shooting celebrities for Vogue, Esquire, and Mademoiselle magazines, to doing a cover photo for an album by The Police, to shooting ads for Revlon and Elizabeth Arden. Michaels' new book, Album, is a retrospective of portraits of friends and family, as well as celebrated artists and actors such as René Magritte, Marcel Duchamp, Joseph Cornell, Clint Eastwood, Sal Mineo, Dennis Hopper, and Meryl Streep. Dwayne Michaels told me that although others may believe in the reality of photographs, he doesn't.
Well, I'm against people believing in the reality of photos because I don't think things are what they appear to be, so I'm kind of in the wrong business. You know, I'm in the business of using a camera, which reproduces reality with great fidelity. But the question is, which reality, or what reality do we really, what assumptions do we make about what we see? And most of the things we see are what we've been trained to see, or we have been conditioned to see, or told it's okay to see. As photographers, there are certain subjects that are okay to see. Those are bona fide, certified subjects. But in my mind, reality is hardly appearances or observable facts. And my reality has to do more with the entire package of experience, my anxieties. I don't separate my dreams as being less real than watching two people kind of do something cute on the corner, you know. So I'm much more interested in myself as an event.
So you really do try to photograph dreams, and you have very dreamlike imagery in a lot of your photographs.
Yes, I try to suggest dreams because you can't really photograph dreams. That's why photographers have never really photographed them or any of that realm of the unspecific, the realm of fear, the realm of desire. I'm not talking about anatomy. I'm talking about desire, which is entirely something else. And those parts of our lives that are simply not visible, which ultimately to me are much more important.
That said, your new book is a collection of portraits.
Right.
Does what you say apply to portraits too, about not believing in the reality of
Absolutely.
It?
And I feel like a hen in the wolf house, like a wolf in the hen house. That too. And because a lot of assumptions, a lot of givens that we seem to have about what portraiture is or what we are or what we project, I don't simply buy and I don't believe in. For example, we're such complicated events. I keep saying events because Buckminster Fuller said I seem to be a verb, but I mean that. And I think he did too. But we're so unknowing and unknown, even to the most intimate friends of ours, even to our lovers, that even most of all to ourselves, that to say a picture of me happened is really who I am or what I am, I think is ridiculous.
You have a lot of like poems and short notes that accompany your photographs. Yeah. And I want to ask you to read an excerpt of what you've written.
For those being photographed, portraiture is essentially about vanity. We want to be told that we are in some way attractive, almost desirable, still young and of value. Anything less is disturbing. We hope for flattery, and all the time we are looking for the wrong thing. We should want clues to our own truth.
That really rang a bell for me when I read that. It really rang true. And I think in a lot of ways people look at photographs of themselves to find out who they are, because you never see yourself and you always feel like you're being judged at least somewhat on how you look. So by looking at a photo of yourself, you're seeing what other people see, or at least you think you're seeing what other people see.
But we never do know. For instance, when you see yourself on a television monitor or something and you realize, my God, look how I walk. We have no real objective view of ourselves. And most of the things we know about ourselves are what somebody else has told us. You know, you're nice. Oh, you're a creep. You know, oh, boy, you fat.
You've written, I am not just this chin, these wrinkles, this nose. Do not be deceived by my face.
Yeah.
Do you feel, I mean, you spend a lot of your time taking the photos of other people's faces.
Yeah.
How do you feel about your own face and pictures of your face?
Well, first, you forgot, also it says, I'm much nicer than my face, which I think is the bottom line. It's interesting because we live in a youth culture, youth-oriented culture, and kind of when you get older, there's this whole tragedy that sets in. The idea that one is not young anymore is a major problem. Unfortunately, we do deal with people. I mean, we do deal with people in terms of what they look like. The beautiful people have great privileges that the less beautiful have. You will take all sorts of baloney from somebody that you find attractive, that you wouldn't put up for 5 minutes for somebody who was short and pimply and bald. Look at Ollie North. I mean, who in the hell would have paid attention to Ollie North if he was short and pimply and bald because he happened to look like a Norman Rockwell Boy Scout? People assumed he was what he appeared to be. So people do judge people on appearances, and which I think is extremely unfair. But I get photographed very often by photographers, and I think photographers themselves are the last person to say no to being photographed when you spend your entire life doing that. But I must say, I need all the help I can get, and I get some really, people should be arrested for some of the pictures I get taken. So I'm just as susceptible to vanity as much as anybody else is, although I know better and I don't believe in it. I don't believe it, you know.
Well, you have a group photo of yourself with all the assistants you've worked with over the years that the photos in your new book were taken. And everybody is perfectly well in focus, except for you. You're very blurry in there.
Well, because it's not about me. It's really about them. And I happen to like blurs, too. I look better blurred.
We're talking about aging faces. There's something that you've written about that in your new book of portraits that I'd like you to read.
Yeah, it says, recently I encountered an old friend of mine whom I had not seen in a while. And at first I did not recognize him. And then I realized that he had acquired his old man's face, and it would be the face that he would die with. And I have my middle-aged man's face. Actually, I remember a while back seeing a picture of Allen Ginsberg. I don't know Allen Ginsberg, but I was familiar with his face. And I read the caption, and I looked again, and it said Allen Ginsberg. Now, that's not Allen Ginsberg. But then I realized, no, he'd acquired his old man's face. My brother's children have their young kid's face, and my assistants have their 20-year-old, 30-year-old faces. And we do. We keep trading in our faces as we get older for the next one. And at this point, I am now. But I realize that when I look in the mirror, I don't recognize myself anymore. I did a little book in France called Changement, which is Changes, and it was about aging, and I described how all the geography of my face had changed and all the lines that had once become, what once had been streams had now become rivers, and how the whole face begins to move very slowly. And in fact, the whole body, again, becomes very slowly back to itself, back to the earth, back almost imperceptibly, you know. But it is like a, anyway, it's quite beautiful, actually.
You know what interests me, though? Most of your photos that aren't the portraits that magazines commission, most of the other photos are really of young, very attractive people.
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, I'm a victim of the Greek ideal, and I wish I could say I didn't find attractive people attractive. But if I would photograph really unattractive people, it would take away from, one could be, if one is distracted by somebody's attractiveness, you are equally distracted by somebody's unattractiveness, which would get more in the way of what I was talking about, because I'm talking about ideas. I'm not really, the people are really models.
Photographer Dwayne Michaels is my guest, and his new book is a book of portraits, which is called Album. You've said that high-style photographers tend to take the same portrait over and over, only the face has been changed.
To protect the innocent. No, it's absolutely true. The style becomes what the photograph's all about, and they use the same light, the same the same background, the same kind of out of focus, fuzzy or whatever, and they simply put a new person in that. So it's more about the photographer's style than it is about the person. I think a good portrait, ultimately the best portraits are the ones that don't necessarily even show what somebody looks like, but have to do with the nature of what that person's about, which is much more difficult to get at.
You know. What you don't relate to is photographers who go to other people's cultures to take pictures.
No, I don't.
And I'm referring here to whites who would go to Harlem or to people who are attractive, who go around photographing freaks.
Right.
You're very alienated by that.
Well, I'm not alienated by it, but it just, it doesn't, it's not what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And the legitimacy of it is not, I don't, I'm not saying that their motives aren't legitimate, but I find one would always be a visitor, no matter how long you lived in Harlem, for example. You could never really understand or know what that means. You were always going to be stuck in there as an observer, and the observer is not the same thing. I think in these portraits in the book, I'm not looking at people as much as I am thinking about them.
Let me ask you about a couple of portraits. You have a portrait of Andy Warhol taken in 1958, which is actually Warhol and his mother. There's two shots. Warhol is standing behind his elderly mother. In the first shot, Warhol's in focus and his mother's out of focus. In the second shot, his mother's in focus, Warhol is out of focus.
Yes. I very often, I noticed in the book something that I do, and that is to photograph people many times. Many views of the same person. I guess, without realizing it, I simply refuse to accept that my nose and my eyes staring at the camera is some all there is to me. So I find myself looking the back of the head or the person in two or three ways, or revisiting somebody years later to see how they've changed, the kind of transition. And in the Warhol case, I did that in 1958, and it was interesting to me because there are two pictures, and in the one picture I really wanted to focus on Andy, and in the second picture I wanted to focus on his mother. So I simply took two different photographs. I have see Dixie Jane Brain. You know, I think I want to see something, I just take two pictures. No, it's really, it works all the time, too.
You have a photograph of Bill Cosby, and you photographed him looking up to your apartment. You're in the apartment
shooting
from
down.
A second story or some third story.
Second story,
second story, shooting down at him. It seems like a strange choice for an angle.
Well, I had photographed him in the house,
and
I wasn't very happy with any of the photographs. And so as he was leaving, I said, just one last thing. When you go downstairs, we just stop and look up so I can, you know. I very often, when I photograph European celebrities, I like to take them to very American places. And I would, like Marguerite Duras on the bus.
Yeah, right.
Or William Klein in the subway. Or, you know, Rossellini on the street or Bertolucci on the street. Because they're anonymous and it's something incongruous about seeing them in a typically American situation where nobody knows who they are. So in this case with Bill Cosby, I just liked it. I liked the way it looked.
In an era where candid photography was becoming very popular, you were doing very controlled photographs with you doing the controlling. Are you not interested in candid photography?
Not particularly. There's that whole school of thought is, you know, that life happens and I'm just a palm tree. Don't look at me and I'll take your picture, which is fine. I mean, I'm not saying that's illegitimate or I'm not authentic. In my case, in all my work, I very much take charge and kind of control the situation as much as I can. It's more of being a director. I don't think that you can get wonderful accidents if you let people do things. You know, and something interesting can always happen. But I'd much rather take charge and, in some subtle way, create the photograph rather than just having to catch a photograph. They're two different activities.
Your work directing photographs is probably even more fully realized in the sequences you've done. You've done many, many series of sequence photographs where there's four or five, maybe six photographs in sequence, and they tell a story, or they tell frequently a dreamlike story. And you frequently write captions to go along with them, little narratives that describe the story that's being told.
Yes. I am by nature, I think, a storyteller. I'm not quite sure about that, but it seems it's pointing in that direction. I believe in the imagination, and people think it's quite natural for people to write stories and to paint and do. But someone in the photography world, the notion that somebody would set up a story seemed very alien and quite bizarre. Certainly when I started out in the mid '60s. But for me, because I admire people like William Blake and Lewis Carroll, I think the imagination is the great gift we have. And photographers who spend their whole lives looking for life don't seem to realize they are the event. And once you realize that you are this event in time, then your mind is the source of everything, which in fact it is, but we simply don't recognize that. So it's very natural for me to do this.
I want to talk with you more about your photographs and your life, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is photographer Duane Michaels. His new book is a series of portraits, many of which were commissioned by magazines, and the portraits include such people as Sal Mineo, Sting, Rene Magritte, Robert Duvall, Marcel Duchamp. Michaels has described himself as trying to photograph the unphotographable, and we'll talk more about that after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Photographer Duane Michaels is my guest, and his latest book is a collection of portraits called Album. Now, some of the people in the new book are artists who are well known to other artists and to people who follow art, like Marcel Duchamp and Joseph Cornell. Some of them are celebrities and movie stars that everyone would know, Sal Mineo, Meryl Streep. Do you like photographing celebrities?
I like photographing celebrities, yes. It's fun, and it's always, you know, it's fun to photograph a celebrity. We're celebrity freaks in this country, but I'm not dazzled by them, and I don't believe them, and I've done it enough such a long time that they don't sort of bowl me over the way they did the first time I did it. But in this particular book, I didn't want it to be another catalog of celebrities. Most portraits of celebrities, well, first of all, there's no such thing as a bad picture of a celebrity. Even the worst picture of a celebrity is still of interest. It's just money in the bank. But I wanted this to really be about a lot of friends and my family and my nephews, and also about people I know in the country and just people who are not celebrities.
Let's talk a little bit about your family. Mm. Now, you grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania. You're from a Czechoslovakian immigrant family.
My grandparents were. I'm second generation.
Your mother, when you were growing up, was a live-in domestic.
At one point, yes.
With a wealthy family. This was for about 5 years when you were young.
When I was small. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, when you grew up and started photographing people who were very wealthy, if you felt uncomfortable or out of place.
Oh, no, never. As a matter of fact, now that I am wealthy. No, that was never a problem. I have a great deal of chutzpah. And the one thing you get, I think, from coming from an immigrant background is that it takes a certain kind of
moxie.
Yeah, get here in the first place. And I had a terrific grandmother. And, you know, we would watch, what was his name, Ed Sullivan on television. And there'd be some crooner croaking. She'd slap me in the arm and say, "You can sing as well as that. Why aren't you on television?" You know. So there was never any kind of. My mother and father are terrific. My father worked in the steel mill, worked very hard all his life, and they gave us, my brother and I think, a real sense of confidence. And if you want it, go get it, because nobody's going to give it to you. And so I come from the work background and the work ethic, but also there was always that sense that we could do anything if we would put our mind onto it, and in fact we have.
Now, you've created an alter ego for yourself named Stefan
Mihal.
Mihal, right. Okay. And you describe him as the man I never became. You say, "I saved myself from him." You describe him as a hairy working-class hulk with a wife and three children.
That's right.
How did you invent him, and what does he represent to you?
Well, I think everybody has a person they didn't become. Uh-huh. The minute you decided to go to this school and not to that school, the minute you decided to date her and not her, or whatever. We make choices all the time. Those choices actually shape us into the person we did become. But there are all these other people we never became. I've always been fascinated by. It's like matter and antimatter. And should I encounter him, I think we'd both blow up. In fact, that's what I think that big hole in Siberia is, because two people who never became each other finally met. I'm fascinated with the idea of personal identity. People assume all the labels and packaging, just the things I rattled off, steelworker's son and that kind of thing. But as a matter of fact, those are the decorations. They have absolutely nothing to do with that essential energy. I'm not going to say cosmic, that sounds too pretentious, but this universal energy that we are.
Have you figured out a way to take the photograph of your alter ego?
No. I think I've sort of pretty much dispensed with him at this point. He's always there. He's always a shadow there. But now I'm under other problems. I won't say problems, but other issues, which I find more interesting.
Such as?
Well, I've always been interested.
Oh, name those issues.
Yeah, you name that issue. What do I win? No, but one thing that's always intrigued me is the metaphysical questions. I guess it's now that I'm older, I'll be 57 next month, as you get closer to terminal time, you begin to reevaluate a lot of your assumptions, and the questions at this point are, because I've satisfied a lot of things I wanted to solve, I have solved. So now they are, what do I do with the rest of my life, and what is it all about in the most profound way? So the metaphysical questions keep coming back to the fore. The question of sensuality and one's own sexuality is always an issue. I don't care how old you are, it simply doesn't go away. It simply the questions reform themselves. And these are profound issues that have absolutely nothing to do with style or glitz or, current issues. These really are questions that people will always ask.
Even though you've basically dispensed with your alter ego, I'm going to quote him.
Sure. Well, he's...
and, your alter ego has said, if Duane wants to take pictures, he should do a study of laborers and farm workers and unwed mothers and make some social changes. Mm-hmm. Do something for someone else, something noble. That's what I would do. Yeah. Is that something you had difficulty resolving, the fact that you weren't doing photographs that were documenting politics or creating social change?
Not at all, because... you see, that's my alter ego saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to voice that because, not because I felt that I should be doing that, but because that's one of the things that is always, photographers are traditionally expected to address. In my case, I felt that I'm just offering another option and that there are other issues about life that are also, in fact, more profound that are never addressed by photographers. There are many photographers doing this kind of photography, but there are other issues. I mean, as I said, the metaphysical things. Not what things look like so much. I think ultimately what I'm interested in is not what things look like, but what things feel like. And consequently, I always fail. Because you can't. My photographs are approximations. They're only suggestions. They're not the fact itself.
Some of your photos are very erotic and very, very arousing.
Yummy.
Frankly, though, they made me think about something which I've thought about before, too, which is the connection between eroticism and fetishism.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if I can explain what I mean. There's a photograph you have that I'm sure a lot of people have commented on to you. It's of a woman kind of half undressed, her stockings are pulled down.
Oh, yes.
What, describe the photo.
Mm-hmm. Well, I took that a long time ago. It's a photograph of a woman laying across a bed, and she's pulling up a skirt, and she's revealing herself to be nude with her pants pulled down. And the reason I did that photograph was I realized that a person can be totally dressed but just reveal one part of the body. And it's a woman totally dressed who just reveals a breast is much more erotic than a woman completely nude. So it really depends. Also, if you notice that photograph, what I love about it, the only real perversity in the picture in my mind is a picture on the dresser of a little boy and his mother. And that's, to me, the most interesting part, because I kept thinking, that's in that little boy's room now that he's grown up, that his mother wouldn't have approved. I mean, I love little tiny things like that. But what's interesting to me about that photograph, though, was that, again, the principle that one can be totally dressed and just, of course, she's doing something really, really kind of beyond just revealing a breast. But I'm much more interested in sensuality. I'm not interested in the mechanics of sex, and I would never photograph the sex act. Or I'm not interested in anatomy as equipment. as sexual equipment. I'm much more interested in the I almost said aroma, but I mean that too. But the atmosphere of sex, like in Balthus's paintings, where nothing tangibly happens, but there's such a sense of eroticism. You can cut it with a knife. So I might. Bill Brandt said all good photographs have atmosphere. So the difference is I'm not interested in anatomy, and I'm not interested in the functioning of sex or costumes and that kind of business. But what is intriguing is the intangible sense. Suppose you're in a relationship or you encounter somebody, and there's that, you know that there's this excitement in the air, that something is possible. The stares are too long, you know, the eyes have met. That to me is much more interesting than, I'm getting very nervous here, much more interesting than photographing, close-ups of genitalia.
A lot of people think that photos should speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And usually the only photos that have mm-hmm. captions are the mm-hmm. photos of photojournalists, and the caption
right.
describes where the event happened
exactly.
and what the political
yeah.
context or the social context mm-hmm. was. Did you ever feel like you were, that your photos should be able to speak for themselves mm-hmm. without the narrative that you provided? Mm,
sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in rules like that at
mm-hmm.
all. I think photos fail constantly.
Fail
constantly. In fact, they lie constantly, too. My best example, I think, is a picture I took of my mother, my father, and my brother a long time ago, and I wrote a piece with it called A Letter from My Father. So what I do is not to show you what you're looking at, or to tell you what you're looking at, but to tell you what you can't see. So I'm driven to write because what's important to me was not what my father looked like. In fact, I'm sure that the most interesting photograph of my father has marginal interest for anybody, including me. But what I've had to deal with was the legacy of our relationship, and that was invisible, and that I have to write about. So I write not to be clever or because I think I'm a good writer, which I'm not, but I write out of the frustration to express what you can't see. And people are not what they appear to be. Things are not what they appear to be. And I think that's the most important thing to realize.
So what did you write in the photo of your father?
I remember it very clearly. It said, as long as I can remember, my father always said to me that one day he would write me a very special letter, but he never told me what the letter might be about, and I used to try to guess what mystery, what family secret could now be revealed, what intimacy we would alas share. I know what I had hoped in there I would read in the letter. I wanted him to tell me where he had hidden his affection, but then he died, and the letter never did arrive, and I never found that place where he had hidden his love. So... And it's a true story, actually. When I was going to school in Colorado, when I was 17, the night before I left, my dad said, one day I'm going to write you a letter. It's something I want to tell you about. And then he never wrote the letter, and we began to joke about it as I got older. But an interesting thing is I know what he was going to write about now after all these years.
Really? What was it?
I can't tell you.
Oh. Okay. you have several books of your photographs, which work very well with, mm-hmm. with the writing
yeah.
next to it. What's the difference between a book and a gallery show for you?
Oh, I'm not very much interested in gallery shows at all. I'm not interested in the perfect print. I'm really interested in ideas, and I've always loved books. The only thing I spend money on would be books. This sweater's 40 years old, for God's sake.
But colors are still bright.
That's right. I need it. But I would think for a long, long time before I would spend $100 for a piece of clothing. And I would buy a book for $100 without even thinking about it for 2 seconds. So I prefer books. Prints and gallery shows are interesting, ultimately. But for me, only ones where I show new material. But a book is so wonderful. You can take it home and you can go to bed with it and read it. It's a one-to-one basis. You could go back and relook at it. Books are just terrific.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I had a good time.
Me too. Thank you. Mm-hmm. My guest has been Duane Michaels, and his new collection of photographs is a collection of portraits. It's called Album, and it's published by 12 Trees Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And next time, we'll have a live concert with jazz pianist Dave McKenna, so I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Signe Wilkinson's cartoons in Ms. Magazine and the Philadelphia Daily News have lampooned politicians, bureaucrats, parents, even other cartoonists. Coming up, Signe Wilkinson talks about some of her recent targets. Every Christmas, we all hear the same excerpts of The Nutcracker over and over again. Today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of the lesser-known parts of Tchaikovsky's famous ballet. And to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Raymond Chandler's birth, commentator Maureen Corrigan looks at the legacy of the writer who helped create the hard-boiled detective genre. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Authorities in Great Britain have concluded that it was a bomb that destroyed Pan Am Flight 103 a week ago over Scotland. Test results confirming the presence of explosives were announced today. We have two reports on the announcement and on the U.S. role in the continuing investigation. First, we go to London and NPR's Bill Buesenberg.
Military explosive experts tested several pieces of wreckage. Initial news reports said the experts found metal slivers in some of the bodies from the plane, as well as metal fragments in a suitcase and heat damage in a cargo bay. All are consistent with a bomb. Late today, the official results of the tests were announced in Lockerbie by Mick Charles, chief of Britain's Air Accident Investigation Branch.
It has been established that two parts of the metal luggage pallet's framework show conclusive evidence of a detonating high explosive. The explosives residues recovered from the debris have been positively identified and are consistent with the use of a high-performance plastic explosive.
Authorities have not determined what type of plastic explosive was used or where it was placed, but the forward cargo hold is considered most likely. A massive international criminal investigation, including Scotland Yard and the FBI, has now been mounted to find out who might have planted the bomb. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
I'm Ann Garrels in Washington. FBI Director William Sessions told a news conference this afternoon, British authorities will take the lead on the investigation, with the FBI working closely with them, though how close has yet to be established. For instance, U.S. officials say it's still unclear if U.S. police officers can be present at the interrogation of suspects, if they can do their own interrogations on British soil, or if they must rely on British reports. U.S. officials say they have no hard leads on who might have planted the bomb. According to one intelligence official, any names or groups mentioned at this point are a result of pure speculation, nothing more. Sessions said the bombing could be either a terrorist attack or a criminal act. One group that might be able to provide information is the Palestine Liberation Organization. But while U.S. officials now have authorized a formal dialogue with the PLO, they have not approached the organization for help. However, said one official, if the PLO came to us first, we would listen. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
President-elect George Bush today announced the choice of Robert Gates to be his deputy assistant for national security. As the number two man at the CIA, Gates was criticized by Democrats and Republicans alike for his role in preparing the late CIA Director William Casey's testimony to Congress on the Iran-Contra affair. Much of that testimony has since been shown to be inaccurate. The controversy forced President Reagan to withdraw Gates' nomination to head the CIA when William Casey died. Bush, who is vacationing in Texas, also announced the nomination of Richard Kerr to replace Gates as deputy CIA director. Kerr is currently deputy CIA director in charge of intelligence operations. Two Palestinians were shot dead and at least 13 others wounded today during clashes with Israeli soldiers in the West Bank. The fighting came amid a general strike that shut down businesses throughout the occupied territories. The Israeli army also reported that troops killed three guerrillas near the country's border with southern Lebanon. It was the third reported infiltration attempt in 5 days. A leading Egyptian official today accused Israel of not being serious in its latest peace plans. Osma al-Baz said Israel and Egypt must come close to agreement on the essential elements for peace before President Hosni Mubarak could visit the Jewish state. Al-Baz, a top advisor to Mubarak, said Israel's latest peace proposals are just gimmicks aimed at diverting world attention. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 4 points to close at 2166.43. Advances led declines 6-5. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of an album that includes music associated with the holiday season. But he says this performance, which is conducted by the late Russian maestro Yevgeny Mravinsky, is one you'll want to keep listening to well into the new year.
The holiday season is a time for sweets, candy canes and sugar plums, panettone and marzipan. But perhaps the best-loved sweet of all is the sweet from Tchaikovsky's Christmas ballet, The Nutcracker. Before the ballet was ever performed, Tchaikovsky himself stitched together this series of brilliantly organized, self-contained dances, an enchanting string of musical bonbons. But anyone who's seen the ballet or heard the complete score knows that some of the best music from the ballet isn't included in the suite. Philips Records has recently issued a marvelous Nutcracker suite recording, but on it you won't hear most of the music you expect. In fact, it's a selection of major scenes from the ballet chosen not by the composer, but by the conductor, Yevgeny Mravinsky, one of this century's greatest Russian conductors. Mravinsky died early this year, and not many of his recordings were ever available in America. This one comes from a live New Year's Eve concert he gave with the Leningrad Philharmonic on December 31, 1981. Mravinsky's selection is masterly and is a perfect example of one of the distinctive features of his career. He started out as the conductor of the Kirov Ballet. Then in 1938, he became the director of the Leningrad Philharmonic. That's probably why his ballet performances had a symphonic cohesiveness and structural power. And the symphonies he conducted had the rhythmic buoyancy of dance music and flowed with a storyteller's hypnotic intensity. Listen to this music, for instance, from the scene where the guests leave the Christmas party and the world of magic and dreams begins to take over. Paradoxically, by emphasizing the storyline of the ballet, the aftermath of the Christmas party, the battle between the toy soldiers and the mice, the visits to the kingdom of snowflakes and the land of sweets, Mravinsky also emphasizes the symphonic elements in the score, Tchaikovsky's larger-scaled structures, and some of his most inventive orchestrations. It also happens to include one of my favorite parts of the ballet, the Waltz of the Snowflakes, and I've never heard it performed with more elegance and sweep. Thank you. There's also another selection on this album, music from Prokofiev's second ballet suite from Romeo and Juliet. And it's one of the most powerfully dramatic performances of this score I've ever heard, even menacing in places. It's fascinating to compare this performance to Prokofiev's own more deliberate and more complete performance on a Philips legendary classic CD, a recording that also includes another famous piece of dance music conducted by its composer, Ravel's Bolero. I'll talk about that next week.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new Philips recording featuring Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite and Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. This is Fresh Air. Signe Wilkinson took a count recently of the number of women editorial cartoonists working for a major daily and discovered that there were only three. Wilkinson is one of those three. She's the editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia Daily News. She worked at the San Jose Mercury News before coming back to Philadelphia, her hometown. Wilkinson covers a wide range of national and local political events in her cartoons and does a lot more on women's issues than most of her male counterparts. For the past year, she's drawn a monthly cartoon for Ms. magazine. I asked her to describe a recent cartoon she drew for Ms. on the anti-pornography movement.
The cartoon is two women in a small car going along a main street, sort of a typical American main street with little shop windows, and one has T-shirts with a happy face and one saying, "There's no sex like no sex." And the politically correct adult bookstore, it's 99.9% pure. And then the sort of central landmark is a movie marquee with the title, "Debbie Does Volunteer Work," on it. And one woman is saying to the other, "Who runs this town, fundamentalists for Robertson or feminists against porn?"
So that cartoon is comparing women against pornography type groups with the fundamentalist right. You really have to know where you stand before you draw a cartoon that makes such an overt comparison.
Well, I think that's what comes first in the cartoons, or at least in mine, the position before the joke. I mean, if you just have a joke, you can apply it to any situation in the world. If you have a position, then you work out the metaphor that fits your point of view.
A lot of the cartoonists who you hear the most about are cartoonists who do nationally oriented cartoons, cartoons about national politics, and these are the syndicated cartoonists. You work at the Philadelphia Daily News.
Right.
And you do a lot of cartoons each week about local politics and other local issues. Do you find that local politicians are more sensitive about a cartoon that treats them negatively than the national politicians are? National politicians are the brunt of so many cartoons and so many columnists, whereas local politicians, in Philadelphia, for instance, there's just really a couple of dailies following them, and I would guess that they're more sensitive about it.
You're right. They are. And if we get sued, we don't get sued by George Bush or Ronald Reagan. We would hear from the lawyers of whatever politicians in town. And I think that's why local cartoons are really important, and why syndication has often worked against local cartooning for the really top cartoonists, because to feed the syndicate a certain number of national or international cartoons means that they can't do the local cartoons. This last weekend, I've just read in the papers about Marion Barry in Washington, D.C., there's some flap about him frequenting a hotel where a drug dealer was plying his trade, and the policemen apparently were called off from going to get this dealer because the mayor was around. And the cartoonists can't follow a story like that the way we could here. And yet, for the people in Washington, D.C., that's a big story. And that happens all over the country in every city.
You mentioned lawsuits. What kinds of things could a cartoonist be sued for? After all, it's political humor that you're doing, and you're working in metaphor a lot.
Right. Well, the difference between metaphor and and reality are some readers can't tell the difference. A lot of readers can't tell the difference, especially if you're the butt of the joke. Also, you know, I think when people get on to a national level, their hide is so thick they can't. I mean, what's another little cartoon? It's just a little pinprick, especially as you say, there are hundreds of cartoons coming out every week about Reagan and Bush, and they're more likely as not to call up the cartoonist and ask for an original. And that doesn't really happen around here too often.
Has the threat of a lawsuit ever chilled your work, ever forced you to tone it down or convinced an editor that the cartoon shouldn't be printed because it would be too risky?
I had an incident recently about that. I did one. Well, the specifics are unimportant, but it was about a person, and the facts were a little bit unclear. And the night editor called our lawyer, and the lawyer said, not seeing the cartoon, said, "Well, this might be risky," and the cartoon didn't run. We had big fights the next day, and it was slightly revised, and I ran it the day after. But boy, that's just an awful experience, because there's something magic about a cartoon. I mean, there's something that when you start defending your cartoon and going into what every word means and explaining the joke over and over again and why it's not offensive and blah, 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 blah. It just, the cartoon itself, I don't want to run them. I mean, they look dead to me. They look like, you know, the fish that they eventually will end up wrapping. And I just, it does put a chill on it.
You did a cartoon about a cartoonist that I'd like to have you describe for us.
Well,
this goes in context. There was a day set aside earlier this year when all cartoonists were asked to do a cartoon about homelessness in America. Mm-hmm. And this was your cartoon.
Well, my cartoon is a young, good-looking, mustachioed man walking by a bum on the street with his hand outstretched over a steam grate. And the cartoonist is looking down at him, rather annoyed, saying, "I drew an extremely poignant cartoon about you. What more do you want?"
Who are you thinking of when
us.
You do that?
The cartoonists are paid to be poignant and sympathetic and you know, pull at our heartstrings and point out the ills in society. But we're also, generally speaking, in a fairly well-paid position. And it kind of annoys me when we all get together and to be sanctimonious together. I think that the cartoons lose punch. They also lose a little of their intellectual vigor when everyone's going to be sappy the same day for homeless. Ditto war toys. We've had a number of campaigns that along these lines, and I just don't like to get involved in them. It's also asking people to do stuff that we're not necessarily doing. I mean, I did not go home that night and invite a family in to have dinner or spend the night. I just went home and had dinner with my family and collapsed.
Well, that raises a question that I'm sure has been of concern to you. I mean, you do all these social change-oriented cartoons, mm-hmm. and do cartoons that criticize what you think is wrong with politics, with city government, mm-hmm. with society, with child care, the way it's currently offered. I'm sure you have no time to be an activist in any way yourself. Do you ever feel bad about that, that you're taking all these stands but don't have the time in your own life to follow through on them?
Oh, yes. I mean, guilt is a great part of everyone's life, isn't it? I mean, cartoonists are no different. But I do a lot of cartoons for organizations, and I hope that that is a benefit to them that they can use. It better be.
Well, did you arrive at something, at the idea personally that everybody does what it is they do best and that's what it is that they should do? You know, that your best work, your best contributions might be in the form of cartoons as opposed to...
Going in and messing up somebody's perfectly good program with my with my own disorganization? Yes, well, I should hope so. My husband's also very active, you know, helping in several nonprofit agencies. And so I figure I'll get to heaven on his coattails.
You take the train in a mm-hmm. lot to work, and everybody on the train is always reading the newspaper, right? Mm-hmm. Do you ever see people reading your cartoons on the train and watch their expression?
Mm-hmm. Only on the train ride out. Ours isn't one of the few afternoon papers left in the country. But, yeah, in the afternoon I see some people paging through it. And, of course, it's, you know, it's so unbelievable. They just, you've spent a whole day doing this, and they spend, oh, I'd say 3 seconds, maybe four, and turn the page. It puts your work in perspective, I think. Except for the head of housing gets on a few stops after me, and he always has an early edition of the Daily News. I don't know where he gets it. But if he doesn't like it, he yells at me on the train. So I do hear a little bit about it in the morning.
Signe, thanks a lot
for talking with us. It was great to be here.
Signe Wilkinson is the editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia Daily News, and her cartoons regularly appear in Ms. Magazine. She's also a vice president of the Association of Editorial Cartoonists. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, so I guess it was confirmed today that the plane last week was downed by a bomb.
That's right. That's been the finding of the investigation, especially after British inspectors looked at one piece of luggage that evidently bore the marks of an explosion. We'll be hearing about that both from Britain and from here. We'll also be talking with Stephen Mitchell, a poet, who a couple of years ago translated the Book of Job, treating it very much as a work of literature. He has now translated the Tao Te Ching, but without knowing Chinese. It's an interesting work. And we'll also talk with Brazilian-American guitarist Carlos Barbosa Lima about Rhapsody in Blue.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. ...1988 should not pass without us taking notice of the 100th anniversary of the birth of the master of the detective novel, Raymond Chandler. Chandler died in 1959, but his work had already changed the language and texture of American pop culture. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of a couple of commemorative publications and some thoughts on Chandler's legacy.
This year, fans of the hard-boiled detective novel have been raising their whiskey bottles and knocking back a stiff one in memory of Raymond Chandler. To mark Chandler's centenary with more refinement, Vintage Press has reissued his 7 novels. Gone are the pickled corpses and bare-chested blondes who jazzed up the novel's covers when they were considered just pulp fiction. But what this new edition gains in class, it loses in legibility. The print here is tiny, as hard to read as Philip Marlowe's thoughts. Like Chandler's women, the vintage edition of his novels is nothing but trouble, wrapped up in a slick package. Another uneven anniversary tribute is Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe, a collection of 23 new Marlowe stories by contemporary detective writers like Roger L. Simon and Jeremiah Healy. These spin-offs of Chandler's style are very polished, but so what? Anybody who does a Humphrey Bogart impersonation can write like Chandler. Well, not quite. The force of Chandler's writing isn't just in his hip metaphors or spare cadences. It's in his whole vision of a world gone wrong. Chandler's L.A. is filled with people who've chased their dreams to the edge of the Pacific, only to be conned one more time. Even in the throwaway scenes Chandler wrote, the romantic will to believe in love and possibility wrestles with cynicism. Listen to this passage from The Big Sleep, where Marlowe first meets villainous Carmen Sternwood. She was 20 or so, small and delicately put together, but she looked durable. She walked as if she were floating. Her eyes were slate gray and had almost no expression when they looked at me. She came over near me and smiled with her mouth, and she had little, sharp, predatory teeth, as white as fresh orange pith and as shiny as porcelain. They glistened between her thin, too taut lips. Her face lacked color and didn't look too healthy. "Tall, aren't you?" she said. "I didn't mean to be." Her eyes rounded. She was puzzled. She was thinking. I could see, even on that short acquaintance, that thinking was always going to be a bother to her. Chandler was 48 when he published his first story. His metaphysical ambitions for the detective novel slowed down his development as a writer. He probably wouldn't be surprised that critics compare him to T.S. Eliot and other highbrow chroniclers of the modern wasteland. Chandler might be dismayed, however, by the new generation of female, gay, and sensitive male detectives who claim an affinity with Marlowe. Sarah Paretsky's V.I. Warshawski, Richard Stevenson's Donald Strachey, and Robert Parker's Spencer share Marlowe's nerve as well as his awareness of society's moral failure. Like Marlowe, they're outsiders, but their alienation from mainstream America arises from their marginalized cultural identities. And unlike Marlowe, who's both ennobled and disfigured by his isolation, these new detectives seek out other exiles from the nuclear family and with them create alternative models of community. Their adventures have a political charge that Marlowe's dead-end existentialism lacks. No doubt Chandler would have viewed the current popularity of these female and feminized male detectives as proof of the final breakdown of Western civilization. But these newest inheritors of the hard-boiled tradition really just confirm his hunch about the depths of possibility lurking in detective fiction.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Bryn Mawr College and reviews books for The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, another installment in our series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. We meet jazz critic Kevin Whitehead. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker looks at the increasing use of rock music in film scores. He has a review of three soundtrack albums that have lives independent from their respective films. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Working Girl, the new comedy directed by Mike Nichols, starring Melanie Griffith, Harrison Ford, and Sigourney Weaver. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.